Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, February 17th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, then the Bankster Mind with Stuart Thompson, and then in Let's Go to Movie, a review of the Millennium Trilogy. Very, very exciting threesome coming out, both novels and movies coming out of Sweden. Our theme tonight is the first ever planetary debt-to-equity swap. You know how hard I try to encourage you to see the economy as a sort of a living organic system. And literally what we're watching after having watched the first sort of planetary bubble pump and dump, it's not surprising that we should end up having to do a debt for equity swap. Now, for those of you who are not financial people, what is a debt for equity swap? You'll sometimes see a corporation who has lots of debt outstanding do a debt for equity swap where they tender for the debt, sometimes swapping it for equity or putting out new equity. And simply that change in their capitalization structure is called a debt for equity swap. And literally that's now what we're going to watch engineered, not just at the company level, but at the household level, at the government level. It's going to be planetary. And as you look across all the different stories of what's happening economically, that's part of what you're watching. It's interesting. I had talked to Stuart Thompson about talking about the Bankster Mind. He is just phenomenal at sort of seeing the games that the insiders are playing. And if you read his updates at Graceland Update, he talks about it incessantly, really as a tactician. And yet I interviewed him early this week. He gets up at 4 a.m., so we did a pre-interview and recorded it for you. And what Stuart did was very carefully go through the phenomena of turning from a long-term bull market in the bond market to having to switch to something else and money coming out of the bond market. And it's so good we took a little bit of extra time. So if we go over today, I apologize, but I really want you to hear this because this is a very big and very deep and very simple thing, and it's important for you to understand it. So I was delighted that he did that. Okay, a planetary debt for equity swap, what does it look like? Well, in a bubble, you print lots and lots of paper. You print currency. You print treasury securities. You print even more of those now with derivatives. And you get bigger and bigger and bigger pools of paper while the supply of real things, whether it's land or livestock or seed banks or precious metals or tangibles of any kind, those remain relatively static. And of course what that means is you have more and more paper chasing sort of a finite limited supply of real things. Now, what does that look like at a household level? Well, it means there's going to be tremendous pressure on your expenses and things, and that's why I keep talking about the importance of arranging your own food supply, energy supply if you can. At the community level, it's translating into rising utility prices, pressure on municipal budgets, all the different stresses we see. At the state level, same thing. Cutbacks, very serious governance problems. At the municipal level, there's more of an intimate communication and a sharing of the challenges. At the state level, it gets rougher. We're watching an amazing situation in Wisconsin where, according to the reports tonight, literally to avoid having to be part of a vote, the Democrats are boycotting the Republicans' effort to cut back the rights of union labor and collective bargaining in the state. Some pretty draconian things going on. We literally see Democrats leaving the state so the police can't round them up at the request of the Republicans. It's a pretty extraordinary circumstance. And crowds reported of 30,000 and more literally coming to march on the Capitol. What this translates to in the financial markets is money shifting out of the fixed income markets and into tangibles and equities. And that's a real challenge because there's so much money sitting in the fixed income pools and the markets, the equity markets and the tangibles are relatively smaller. And that doesn't even count derivatives if we should start to get a big shift there. The latest figures show 13th week of really significant redemptions in the municipal bond market. That's money fleeing the one part of the fixed income market. Latest figures show, and if I could just get one headline in your head this week, it would be in the last 7 months, sugar futures are up in price 88%. So if you haven't gotten off your sugar for health reasons, pretty shortly you're going to want to get off of it for financial reasons. John Williams at ShadowStats put out a new report on inflation. It's quite extraordinary. He's one of the best people tracking it. What it shows is the official CPI is up 1.6% in January. He shows the actual adjusted CPI for the manipulations up 9%. 9% a month, you're talking about real significant increase in consumer price costs. So that report is up for subscribers at ShadowStats and is worth taking a look at. Very interesting story from Krugman. I'm not a real fan of Paul Krugman, who writes for the New York Times. He's usually pressing the official story, but he did do a story this week on the budget, which I put up on the blog, and it's an interesting one. He talks about the fact that the Pew Foundation recently did a survey that showed that people support cutting, and the cutting they support is other people. He writes in it, the moral is clear. Republicans don't have a mandate to cut spending. They have a mandate to repeal the laws of arithmetic. Now, this is the political pressure we're seeing all across the planet. It's not just in the United States. It's in Europe. It's in the emerging markets. It's everywhere. If you look at our success at pushing away any kind of accountability that would have shown up if we had had a sound currency and really used markets, and using fiat currency and the bubble to kind of push off dealing with what I call peak everything, and we talked about when Chris Martinson was with us, that's now all coming to a head. And what it means, well, let me just look at an overview of our options as a civilization. We can change. That's one thing we can do. We can decentralize. We can reduce centralized control. We can start living much more sustainably. We can let markets and sound currency work. We can stop spending money on war and control. We spend over $1 trillion a year for war and armaments and armies, a fantastic amount of money being poured into that, which begs the question, where have all the proceeds of the organized crime and fraud going? It always irritates me when I see a federal leader say, there's no money. Well, if you look at how much money has disappeared illegally, there can never be enough money if you continue to kind of harvest everything and everyone. And that begs the question, and it's a political question, you know, why are we harvesting it? Where's the money going? How do you get the money back? And there's never going to be enough money if everything just keeps being harvested. Now, the big $64,000 question, and I keep beating this drum, is we can also, in addition to changing, we can unsuppress technology. You know, people always ask me, are you afraid that the price of precious metals can crash? Yeah, well, if we unsuppress all the health and energy technology, which I believe is available, you know, get ready to watch precious metals crash in price. The problem for a lot of the leadership is how do you manage to bring that out and continue to keep the population and the environment in balance? We're out of balance already. And, of course, the final sort of option is to depopulate, and this can be by intentional or unintentional methods. That includes war and organized crime, which have been great depopulators. But now literally what we're seeing across the globe is currency debasement exporting inflation, and that's causing economic chaos and tremendous increase in food prices. And that's a great depopulator. And the perfect example, if you listen to the Solari report we did with Dmitry Orlov, I put a new Orlov video up on the blog this week, or if it's not there, it'll go up next week, talking about what happened in Russia. And again, tremendous depopulation as a result of sort of economic chaos. So the reality is that change is happening. And we don't need to wait for leadership to make, to make those changes or decide what we want to do. We have to proceed. So we have to start to do the change in our own life and certainly do everything we can to avoid being depopulated. So it's not a bad time to learn how to duck, particularly if you're a Wisconsin legislator. Okay, money and markets. Number one story, the weird weather continues. The pressure on the food and energy prices is in part coming from that. As I said earlier when I got on the call and I was talking to our wonderful chief of operations on East Star, last week in Honewell, Tennessee, it was 9 degrees. One morning today, this afternoon, it was 68 degrees. in Bolivar, Tennessee. That is unprecedented for February. We have reports of solar flares knocking out satellites and electrical systems, and more expected today and tomorrow. That story is also up on the blog, a perfect symptom of the geophysical changes and events that continue to put pressure on the infrastructure, food, and energy systems. And they're part of the price inflation phenomenon, and it's going to continue. The Germans bought the New York Stock Exchange, and if there is any more compelling comment on our environment, the silence on the topic, both in the mainstream media and in Congress and from the White House, was absolutely deafening. The one profound comment coming from Charlie Schumer in Congress, saying that he encouraged the Germans to keep New York Stock Exchange at the front of the name. It's just really amazing. Gold and silver have not corrected. They've been moving up again. And I think, in part, it's really the reaction of millions of retail investors watching sort of the significant reengineering, like the Germans buying the New York Stock Exchange, that is happening, and literally saying, you know, things are not as they seem. I need to reposition, and I need to be in a currency that's not, that can protect my purchasing power, has a chance to. I put up a blog post. There's so many stories on the divestment of capital from housing, particularly American housing, that I put a blog post up called Divesting Housing, and if you're interested, take a look. The number of pressures on the housing market are, it's basically getting pummeled from all sides. Interest rates are rising, energy and food and other expenses are rising, incomes are down. You have the foreclosure pipeline being worked through. You have the federal government saying they're going to pull out of Fannie and Freddie, which is more than half of the securitization credit in the market. It's really extraordinary. And so we're literally watching. Part of this planetary debt for equity swap is, if money leaves the fixed income markets and goes into equity, then one of the things it's going to stop doing is providing cheap capital to push up home ownership rates. If you look at all the housing statistics over the last 50 years, a lot of the growth in the value of houses has come from higher and higher per square footages per person. We're going into a world where that's going to reverse. Essentially, what we're going to do is we're going to start moving back to much smaller spaces, much less expensive to maintain, much less energy costs, because cheap financing and cheap federal credit is not going to support it. That's part of what the Freddie and Fannie announcement is. So we're going to start to think of housing. You know, for 50 years, we've thought of housing, our home, as an investment. Now we're going to start thinking of it as a consumption item. And that's a very different way of looking at housing, and it argues for a much lower square footage and much more sort of self-sufficiency in terms of the things that might cause you expenses. Now, last headline, despite Kucinich's best efforts, the Patriot Act has been approved by House and Senate. A real food fight there, but kudos to Kucinich for trying. It was definitely, it showed a lot of gumption on his part. I talked last week that the line management liabilities get scarier. I noted the Wisconsin story, but we're going to see this across the board all around the world. It's going to be harder and harder and riskier to be in the middle of these choices of change versus depopulation versus unsuppressed technology, because trying to build a political consensus is going to be very hard, and leaders are going to be the scapegoat. We saw, this story is up on the blog, Morales. In Bolivia. So you have a leader who's just always been for the people getting attacked by the people. They're angry about food prices. Not his fault. He didn't cause peak everything, and he's not the one inflating the or exporting the inflation, but he's the one who's going to get blamed because he's in the seat. Okay, ask Catherine. Some fabulous questions this week, and I will do my very best to get them all answered if I can. But I can't do it all this week. Again, the precious metals we'll address in the precious metals market report next month. First question, what is your opinion if supposedly money is leaving emerging markets and going into U.S. cap funds? What that means is large cap stocks or funds that invest in large cap stocks. My answer is yes, I believe it's happening. I also think there's a real concerted effort in Europe and America to engineer that. And, you know, we see rebalancing of money going to the emerging markets, then coming back. And it's kind of a neat trick because you export inflation and then you turn around and say, oh, these places aren't good investments because they have all this social unrest and higher food prices and commodity prices. So they're going to tank. And so you export inflation. And what happens? You get lots of capital coming back into your stocks, which makes it easier for you to buy up all the companies that you just exported inflation to. So it's kind of a neat trick. But, yeah, I think it's happening. And I think investors are kind of falling for it and going along. I think it's a short-term phenomenon because ultimately the adjustment is a lot of capital is going to continue to shift into the emerging markets. So look at this as a somewhat temporary phenomena. And how long it lasts and sort of the details of it depend on how forceful we are at exporting inflation and how ugly the peak everything scenario gets. Anyway, but I do think that this is an intentional strategy and it is being pushed. The bigger movement is not from the emerging markets into large cap stocks. The bigger movement is from bonds to equities and tangibles. And one of the real conundrums is the fundamentals are such that equities should be having a very tough, if not terrible, year. The challenge is with so much money looking to leave the bond market, are we going to get an inflation effect that drives stocks up? And that is one of the big questions. And in fact, it's one that Stuart Thompson is going to talk about in our interview tonight. Someone said, where is the list? I had done a list in the last Solari report of my recommendations on DVDs regarding food. And we were hoping to have the list up this week, but we will have we don't have it up. We'll have it up next week. But let me just read off the names to you. I gave my top 10, but also had runner-ups. So I'm incorporating it into a list. The title is Our List of 25 Documentaries and One Movie to Help You Organize Conspiracies to Grow Fresh Food, Finance the Gardeners and Farmers Who Do, and Inspire the Children You Love to Eat Fresh. So let me just read them to you. One, Sir James Goldsmith, Interview with Charlie Rose. You can get that up on the blog. Super Size Me, Morgan Spurlock's DVD about McDonald's. Life and Death in Jamaica. Obesity, Killer at Large, Sugar, The Bitter Truth, The World According to Monsanto, The Oiling of America, The Unhealthy Truth, that's an interview with Robin O'Brien, Scientists Under Attack, that's coming out in March, The Real Dirt on Farmer John, Food Inc., Jeffrey Smith's GMO Trilogy, Sweet Misery, A Poisoned World, that's the one on aspartame, Soylent Green is our one movie, it's a sci-fi horror movie from the 60s, Dirt, the movie, Lunch, Love Community, Fresh, Ingredients, King Corn, Food Stamped, Our Daily Bread, Tapped, that's 22, where's my last list? Oh, dear. Well, from memory, One Man, One Planet, about a Kiwi farmer building biodynamic farming in India. Then Hidden Messages in Water, A Silent Forest, the Growing Threat, Genetically Engineered Trees, and then The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And again, this list will be up on the cart related to last week's precious metals, so you could get the PDF list next week. Next question. Is it true that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton summoned all U.S. ambassadors back to the U.S. this week for a closed-door meeting? If so, any predictions as to why? Yeah, that was 2 weeks ago. A big deal was made out about it by a variety of parties. I see it as being a pretty natural thing for Clinton to want to do. If you look at what's been happening with WikiLeaks, we've seen tremendous leaking of confidential communications between ambassadors and State Department staff and Washington. That puts terrible pressure on the relations within the diplomatic corps and makes it extremely difficult for them to communicate. They don't feel safe to write down what they really think and put it in a diplomatic pouch. So there's a real need with that kind of stress for them to meet face to face under any circumstances. But if you look at what they're dealing with, they're under extreme pressure both in their internal operations and in the countries in which they're serving. Part of this exporting inflation is putting tremendous pressure globally on our relationships with leaders around the world and on various populations. So one is sort of the challenge of price inflation and what it means globally. The second is because we have financial problems, we're cutting back our budgets. So every embassy, every consulate are being asked to cut their budgets and deal with budget cutbacks, which makes it more difficult. If you look at the stresses they're dealing with, if anything, they increase their budgets or their need for resources. And finally, we're cutting back. We're having to use an unprecedented use of force around the world, and that's creating all sorts of issues. So if you look at the situation they're handling and you look at what the impact that the leaks and WikiLeaks is having, the desire to get everybody together and to sort of get on the same page and help each other deal with it is pretty predictable, and it doesn't surprise me, even though it is sort of an unprecedented event. Okay, next question. Hi, Catherine. I'm doing a paper in my fraud examination class about CenTrust. When researching this, BCCI comes to the surface many times. In your interview tonight regarding the banker's mind, which you mentioned BCCI and money laundering, my part of the group paper is to address what can be done. I would like your opinion on that if possible. Well, BCCI is a story near and dear to my heart because in the early 90s, the trustee who'd been asked by the New York Attorney General to oversee the workout of First America, which was the American piece of BCCI. If you remember, Clark Clifford and Wonder Woman's husband, that was First American. And he asked me to go on the board, and I did, and he shipped out over 1,000 pages of legal documents in a Brinks truck, deposited it, and a Brinks guy deposited it in my living room, and I spent a weekend overlooking the Potomac in my glass house reading all these documents. And what became very clear was that this was not an accident. This was a global money laundering scheme that operated with the permission and support of at the highest levels at the White House intelligence agencies, treasuries, banks, everybody. This was no accident. This was no side scheme. This was, the real deal. Now, it's interesting. We did a movie on the Saleri Report, which is a fictionalized version of the BCCI story. And if you want to understand BCCI, I absolutely stress to you it's a must-watch. It's called The International, and it's a great sort of fictionalized account of the sort of the BCCI story. There are also a number of really good books. The challenge you get into when you look at something like BCCI and you watch a movie like The International, the question is, well, what are the solutions? Let me suggest three things to consider. The first is transparency, particularly transparency of government budgets, including credit by place. A lot of the shenanigans get much harder to do when you have real transparency of who's doing what and how they're doing it, and it's tied down to place so that people can see money in contiguous to the world that they can walk around and see. And if there's a great background on that, it's Axelrod's book, The Evolution of Cooperation. It's a quick read, but it really helps you understand the power of transparency. So that would be the first. The second is anything that can be done to encourage people to shift their money to small banks that are accountable locally. I mean, what we can all do is withdraw from we can stop financing the corruption, and I think if that takes on at a grassroots level, it can have a wonderful impact, and that's part of doing the third thing, which is rebuilding the economy and the infrastructure bottom up. The more we can integrate new technology and build resiliency bottom up, the less we can reduce our financial dependency on basically systemic fraud and crime. Anyway, but I would really encourage you to watch The International because I think, it is all in the movies and I think it could help. Okay, so with that in mind, let's begin our interview with Stuart Thompson of Graceland Updates. Stuart Thompson on the Bankster Mind. Okay, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Saleri Report Stuart Thompson. He hails from Ontario, Canada. He's got a background in the large financial institutions, was a broker, and now is the proprietor of Graceland Updates. I get an update every morning, and I always find amazing insights, and I almost always laugh this morning so hard that I cried. It was pretty good. Anyway, it's a pleasure, Stuart, to welcome you to the Solari Report.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about your background. How did you go from being a successful broker at a major financial institution to being the proprietor of Graceland Updates and delighting all of us with your insight, your tactics, and your incredible sense of humor?
Well, it's a fairly long story, but let's see if I can shorten it up. As a child, my father used to subscribe to the Harry Schultz newsletter, and Harry and Jim Sinclair were the two largest players in the gold market in the last bull market. And I wasn't supposed to read the letter, but I used to sneak it off his desk and hide under the covers and read it. And so I very early on started collecting pop bottles, mowing lawns. I was about 8 at the time, and started buying mainly silver. And I ended up getting out pretty much at the top. I got out at 37. So I was, you know, had a keen interest in the financial world, obviously, from an early age. And becoming a broker seemed like a next step. My father was an engineer and my mother was a teacher, so I didn't have too much family guidance on the business end of things, of how to go about things, so I just figured a broker was, you know, the next step, but I always retained an interest in basically in the U.S. Constitution and hard money, paying what you owe, just the basics of life. So I always posted a fax newsletter to my clients. And as I saw the bull market really going in the late 90s, and it really had become out of control to the point that everybody was just pouring money and borrowing money against their homes to play in the market, I suspected another type of 1929 was coming, and in fact, so did the head of Merrill's entire asset management department, but nobody really listened. And so it was like, you know, selling gold to somebody in 1999 was, you know, literally like pulling teeth.
Yeah, that's when I started to buy.
Yes, you're one of the few. So I guess the letters, you know, I became more and more independent, and finally just went completely into independent and built the newsletter from there, and I've never been happier. So
it's nice to be free to say whatever you want.
Sure, I get up early in the morning, and I try to, I try to picture what the reader is thinking, and try to get into their heads a little bit, and address the market in that kind of a sense, and at the same time, you know, I try to bring people the idea that it's, you know, we're in a war in the market, and with the advent of these the computer trading, and some of these systems will cost upwards of $50 million, and it's very difficult for a small investor to compete. So you're in this war all the time, and you need a sense of humor to stay sane. So I try to do that, and you know, another big part of it is trading smaller. I call it trading smaller than you know is rational. It is another mechanism to be able to compete with these huge computers. So that's really what I go to work, you know, every day doing. And as I mentioned, I got you know, a pretty big following of pretty happy people, so I think I'm on the right path.
One of the reasons that I subscribed, Paul Ferguson, who's the treasurer, we have a little investment club called the Solari Circle, and he kept sending me your stuff. He said, you gotta listen to this guy. Is, you know, my whole paradigm for how markets work is warfare. It's economic warfare. And you talk in a language that I understand. And that's why I called our interview today the Bankster Mind, because you're always addressing the games you see people playing. And to me, it's much more realistic than a lot of the market commentary that I read, you know, that's market commentary that assumes that markets are the, you know, the way they taught you in business school as opposed to what we're really dealing with here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a big part of it is, you know, the Bankster Mind, that term, you know, in my view, the banks are the, you know, the best traders. They have the most experience. They're the most well capitalized. And there's, especially out in the gold community, but it, you know, in many areas, there's sort of there's not much of a focus on following what the banks are actually doing in the market. There's, you know, you have groups of people that are either cursing them to death for what they do, maybe out in the political world, and then you have other people, you know, trying to sort of do the opposite of what they're doing, and it's, you know, it's basically, if you're doing the opposite of what the best are doing, you're not very likely to, you know, come out ahead at all, even in the black, let alone, you know, well in the black. So the Bankster Mind is really about, you know, being able to, if you look at the market as a war and a battlefield, and I think what the amateur does is says, well, I have this risk capital that is like my soldiers. So if I take a quick loss, I still have my capital that I can allocate. But what they don't realize is that the banks don't have to control the major trend. They just have to be able to get the opposing side to liquidate at a loss and do it continuously. And if you're continuously booking all these losses while trying to get the main trend going, you can end up in a roaring bull market, you know, as a loser at the end of the bull market because you've been scared out of your position so many times. And
right,
that's, you know, that's sort of what's going on every week in not just in the gold market, but in the main markets.
Well, one of the things I appreciate is you're always trying to discern their tactics and what they're up to. So if you're a general on a battlefield, you need to be discerning what the tactics of the other side is and how they're thinking and what they're doing. So
this is a big issue. I think a lot of people don't realize when they purchase something that there, you know, there's another side to that trade. In the commodity markets, it's direct. For every person that's long or betting it that, you know, a position will go up, there's someone betting it'll go down. But with stocks, it's not exactly like that, but there still is a general, you know, one side is buying and one side is selling. And when you're buying, you sort of want to say, well, what is the other side doing? What is the other side of my trade up to? And if you can kind of get into their mind a little bit, you end up getting into your own mind and you're saying, well, I'm buying this, but I'm really trying to justify what I want to happen more than what's really going on out there. And you know, one of the biggest examples was the fall into the Dow 6500, and most investors really didn't think the Dow could ever fall like that. And there's a sort of, you know, some people say the banks create this sort of, you know, mindset out there, but whether they do or we just fall into it, as bull markets go on, there's a tendency to think, well, this will just go on forever and we can never end up. We sort of evolved past having these depressions or huge corrections. And then when it happens, everybody's in shock and they've never allocated any insurance capital, so to speak, to buy at these lower levels. And this is what I do with the Dow, is I look at the Dow as like a football grid or a battlefield. And you can look at the Dow as, you know, at when it was up at 14,000 and 12,000 now, and look down, and 12,000 points is a long ways down, but $12 a share isn't very far down. So if you broke the Dow into, you know, 12 segments, and then you say I have this much risk capital to allocate, and then you know, in the newsletter I take it further, where you have, just like in a real war, you have, you know, your short-term fighters, your longer-term bombers, and some positions are really never sold. Like positions you've bought into gold 300, even if there was a gold bear market, you don't necessarily want to sell those. The same thing with positions at Dow 6500. These are potentially, you know, lifetime positions that you hold on to. Their wealth is what they are. So
right.
Very difficult for, you know, most people want, and again, there's a focus on, you know, making more dollars. If I buy now, it might go up. They're not really thinking of what they're holding, what it is. You have this chunk of the 30 biggest companies in America at these prices. If you have no capital ready to allocate, you know, at in scenarios that you don't think will happen, there's no possible way you're ever going to take action when they do happen, which they do from time to time. It's just, you never really know which market is going to be next on that list. And now we're sort of in a very kind of lull period where we've had quantitative easing has appeared to fix everything, and
but it hasn't. Did you see the deficit announcement this morning?
I didn't see that, but I don't think I want to see it. I think that, you know, where we are now with the quantitative easing is we're looking at potentially. I think with the quantitative easing, everybody got there. At first, they didn't know what was going on. What is this? Are they just printing money? They're buying these assets. And then as things seem to stabilize, you just kind of fall into, well, since things have stabilized, they must be fixed. And there's so many overhanging OTC derivative contracts still out there. I don't think they could really even buy enough assets to fix this issue. So it kind of it's pushed the issue down the road a little bit. But
I call it kick the can.
Kick the can. Yeah, the old game. and you know, at some point you can't. You reach a point of saturation, which is what I think the average person doesn't want to accept, that they want to believe that there always is a solution for every problem. And, you know, I use the saying that, you know, if you're tied to a chair with a criminal's got a gun to your head, what do you do? Well, sometimes there, you know, you die. And in the market, you're in business, if you've borrowed too much money, sometimes there isn't a solution. And the solution, I think, in this crisis is not quantitative easing. It's just accepting a lower standard of living as it eats into everything. There's been no attempt to reduce, you know, what caused this problem. So it hasn't gone away, and in many ways it's actually gotten worse. And now we're dealing with the bond market that has, you know, stopped going up from the last QE that they did. The bond has actually declined. in price, which means the yield has started to rise. But it, so far, it's not dangerous because it, as they brought rates closer and closer to zero, this is where you get into a parabolic, potentially parabolic rise in the bond price, and you cut rates fractionally and get a huge increase as you're closer to zero in the price of the bond. But it goes the other way too. So if you're a pension manager and you've bought the T-bond up at the pricing of 130 to 140, well,
what do you do?
Well, you're sitting on losses now when it comes down to 120, which it has. But yet the rates haven't really risen, so the average person out there doesn't really see any kind of damage. They think, well, the rates are still low. They're still keeping the rates low. But there's a point where the bond falls down enough that doesn't work anymore. Then the interest rates start to rise, and it's very tricky to know. You know, bond markets last a long time, both bull and bear. So the bull has been going on over 30 years. It may have already ended. I think it did end a couple of years ago, but.
I think it's ended. The question is if you're the pension funds, if you're government reserves, you have trillions sitting in bonds, where do you go?
Well, your mandate, you know, in the gold community, there's a sort of belief, I would almost say a dream that, you know, some percentage, whether it's 1% or 2%, if, you know, there's this dream that if the pension managers put 1% of their money into gold, how high would it go? Well, many of them are mandated against that.
Right.
Many of them just don't like the liquidity issues. You know, they're more focused on equities, and there's only so many gold stocks to buy. They don't want to buy the juniors, and there's many equity funds could just basically buy up all these gold companies. So they're going to look, though, they're trying to do the same thing, hedge themselves against a decline in the dollar. And I think it's very difficult to escape the reality that this debt is essentially unpayable the way things sit now. There's only so many, you know, so much taxes you can take out of all of the groups of people out there, and I think we're very close to the saturation point. So the only way then to pay these levels of debt, which are not being cut but are actually being grown, is to devalue the dollar. And by cutting rates, this is essentially what's happened. These are all tools to devalue the currency, and yes, it's also boosted the growth, but to me, it's insane to actually even state that you're going to pay off these levels of debt by, like, having these little bits of growth in the economy. There's just the levels of debt are too huge. You have to cut.
Yeah, from my point of view, I see the levels of debt at this point in many of these circumstances as being more a control system and a governance system than a financial system. Because you're now able to dictate, you know, private groups are able to now dictate to sovereign governments what they will and will not do, including whether or not they're going to pull the plug on retirees. Because certainly in the Western world, one of the ways you can help to balance this is not just to base the currency, but pull the plug on the elderly.
This is I think this could be very, you know, it almost creates at least, you know, the idea of social unrest in the United States, and it's happened in Europe, and if rather than there again, there's a sort of idea that if you could somehow raise the gold price and devalue the dollar, that the government would come in to confiscate gold, as Roosevelt did back in the 30s. But this is a different situation now. Most of the people hold dollars, not gold. So if your idea is to devalue your creditors, or devalue what you're going to pay back your creditors, which is dollars, it is not really that much point targeting doing like a policy like gold confiscation, because only 2% of Americans own any gold now. So
right.
That opens the door to exactly the pension plans and mechanisms they could do, short of outright saying, well, you know, now your pension has to invest in government bonds. Or what they could do is remove inflation controls, so that, you know, instead of your pension being indexed to the rate of inflation or partially indexed, it's no longer indexed. So if the rate of inflation started rising rapidly, you're not protected anymore. So those are things that could scare pension managers quite substantially, and they're starting to pop up on some of the radar screens. You see, even Bill Gross, who's, you know, runs the world's largest bond fund, has, you know, essentially issued a sell signal on his own fund, which is
sort of almost baffling,
almost unheard of. And
you almost wonder, doesn't he have a fiduciary obligation to the people who are in his funds to shut up?
I think he's more worried about what's going to happen to him if the bond falls apart and he is seen as not having warned them.
Okay.
And I think that's where he's trying to, he would become a giant scapegoat. And I think he knows that he could end up a scapegoat. And I believe his thinking is that if I've correctly told him that the bonds are, you know, the bull market is headed, if they didn't sell, I've been so clear about it. You can't be any more clearer than this. So I can't be the scapegoat. Find another scapegoat, I think, is what he's hoping.
I'm not sure that's going to work, but I can.
Now,
yeah,
I think when things get bad, they do. You're better. You're not going to escape that. So, but definitely the. You know, the pension funds are, I mean, this is a big cash cow for the government to target. And I think what the pension funds are going to look to do is not to buy gold, but to buy into the general equity market. And I think we're already seeing the beginnings of, I wouldn't call it a panic, but I think there's a fear that the dollar is going to have another leg down. They can't buy gold. Many of them are mandated, so they can't buy gold. So what do you buy as an inflation hedge? They're not going to buy houses.
They're going to buy equities.
You're going to buy general equities. Right. And you've seen this huge rally in the Dow that the public really hasn't come in. So ironically, it's caught sort of both the bears and the bulls looking for a correction, and yet the market could start a huge rise even while earnings are actually disintegrating, ironically, just because of the level of institutional liquidity in bonds.
Gives me real pause on the equity markets, particularly the U.S. equity markets. If you really dive in and study naked short selling and then watch the flash crashes, I think there are a lot of retail investors are saying, you know, I'm tired of being a patsy. I'm just tired of being a patsy, because this is just, you know, they're just creating fiat stock, and I just don't want to be a patsy. So there's a visceral reaction to a lack of integrity in the fundamental mechanism.
I think that extends into, you know, into even in the fund community, the gold community. It's in the mainstream community. There's been a general loss of trust, and unfortunately, I think that in the mainstream community, that, you know, the move has been to buy bonds and cash, which may well be the next, you know, the very next target of, you know, so it's sort of like out of the frying pan. And I mean, they look back at the lows in 2008, and the bonds were the place to go for safety. But
right.
This time they may be actually the one.
Right. Well, to me, an equity, in many respects, equities are looking safer and safer if you're in the right equities. Because you'd rather have something that is an essential purpose or, you know, has real demand behind it. You know, yes, it's volatile, but it's real. And whereas something that's just a target and kick the can that's being debased may not be that real.
I think more of that is coming. I mean, there's still going to be products that companies, food companies, basic foods are going to be driven up as the dollar goes down. So companies that are engaged in that type of thing, commodity type companies, just basic goods companies, I think will, you know, continue to do fine. And if there is a rush of liquidity coming in on the institutional side, even some of the other worse companies may still get
the
pushed
spillover
along. But I mean, just to be on the safe side, you always want, you know, you don't want to own something that's just sort of flash in the pan as a in what's arguably the greatest financial crisis, you know, of the last 100 years.
One of the things I've been trying to do for the last 5 days is figure out what in the world is going on over at the New York Stock Exchange. And we have more announcements this morning that a merger with the Germans is expected. And in fact, if you drill down and look at the press release, they're expecting the entity will be owned in the Netherlands or headquartered in the Netherlands. And you've got the German Börse, the Deutsche Börse chairman will be the chair. And then the number two guy, New York Stock Exchange, who's also European, will be number two. And we have Charlie Schumer basically asking them to please leave the name NYSE first. You know, so that we have U.S. congressmen only concerned with appearance. Who knows? But we've gotten very little coverage, and I didn't know if you had a take on this. But to me, this is huge news.
Well, I think this is another step in the globalization that's going on, my take in the larger picture is that this crisis it doesn't lead to a meltdown of the system.
It leads to a consolidation.
It leads to a much, unfortunately, a loss of sovereign power. A fairly big loss of sovereign power.
Right.
And I mean, the New York Stock Exchange going to Germany would have been just years ago. It would have been unthinkable.
Right.
And now it's these types of things are just being passed one after another. And I think what's happened is the public is still kind of, because things have sort of gotten a little bit better, they're just in this kind of watching everything, and it's so big now, how does anyone really mount any kind of debate? These sort of, you know, international agencies that have come up from the IMF, there's dozens of them now that seem to be able to act without sort of the way that a Congress would act, have sort of put through a tremendous amount of this globalization that's, you know, is billed as bigger as better, and is, you know, as you mentioned, is it bigger as better, or is it bigger just kicking the can further? And you've kicked it down.
Well, I think for the people who are centralizing control, it is better. They have, their way of dealing with risk is more central control. So in that sense, I think it's better. And wherever the trillions that have gone, that have been sort of pulled out of North America, they've been the beneficiary one way or another. So for them, I think it is better.
Yes. Yeah, I think, I mean, this is a, you know, what you're seeing in Egypt. I think you'll see the people sort of better off, but are they getting the bulk of the benefit? And you know, I'm not so sure about that.
I'm a skeptic.
And I think that's how this whole globalization thing is sort of playing out, that as it rolls along, there's some benefits, but the bulk of the benefits really are not flowing back outside of that sort of centralized planning group.
Well, let's turn to precious metals for a second, because one of the things I've been doing since the beginning of the year, and I have to confess, is torturing about whether or not we're going to get a correction. And I'm in the camp that thinks we are going to get a correction. And I would love to know what your short-term outlook is for gold and silver.
Well, I like to approach the metals and the idea of an intermediate, if you will, you know, rise or fall from two perspectives. And one is, are you going to get a rally in the dollar? And the other is, are you going to get a fall in the metals prices? And looking at you know, gold in terms of dollars, the reason I do that is because, again, it comes back to that operating in the market as a soldier, and you want to be winning.
Right.
So if gold is going down, the dollar's going up. So if the dollar's going up, I'm winning, and I, you know, at some point I want to be booking profits on that win, which means going back into gold. And so you end up with more, and if you can continually repeat that, you've got more gold, and you have more dollars, and you have more gold. It, as far as gold against the dollar goes, we're into the weak season for gold as a commodity. Typically, once you get in, you know, even into the new year, things tend to, they gyrate around a little bit, but basically from December through to, you usually have one more rally, after December. But I mean, this year we kind of, we went higher after October, but we really haven't gone anywhere. And we've just been in this large congestion area between basically 1310 and 1430. On the charts, some of it appears as a possible top pattern to technicians. That's hard to know. Some patterns tend to be what I call shapes on the chart and not really patterns. They can also not activate. So you could have the pattern there, price starts down, and then it just turns up anyway, and it doesn't, the price doesn't necessarily have to be activated by the pattern. But given that we're, you know, entering the weaker time for gold, that's certainly, leans towards the bear side. As far as, you know, the participants in the gold, you know, I see their actions leaning that way too. There's been a bit of talk of, you know, some sectors in China buying the decline. Well, in China and India, you know, the declines are always bought, but the question is, are there more buyers than sellers? And since October, it's been balanced. That's why we haven't got anywhere, because there's simply been, you know, the buyers have balanced out. And I called the point, I guess it was around October the 10th or the 14th, we ran up to 1387, and I saw in the gold community, I was getting blasted with emails saying chase price. We're going, and this is very, you know, very concerning to me when I see this.
You and me both.
And yeah, very, 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 So I called it the point of loss of sanity in the gold community. And, and in the mainstream community. So I think the gold community did chase price there, and they're kind of all locked in that area of, say, 1350 to 1430. They've done a lot of buying in that area, and they're kind of trapped. And the last fall down to 13, there was some capitulation selling, you know, what was bought earlier. And just the time that we're over 4 months in this, people are starting to get dejected. And what was supposed to be, you know, this rocket taking off instead has just been adrift sideways, you know, followed by a possible, you know, that may now turn into a bigger correction. The mainstream community was a little bit different. I think as we got up towards 1400, people began saying, well, you know, maybe I should come into gold. But, you know, and the people I'm in touch with in the mainstream community were, you know, sort of having meetings with their clients and discussing the gold market, whether it might be here to stay is the phrase they like to use. And so I don't think a lot of buying actually took place. But if we were to get up into back up over 1430, I think they definitely would come in. And one thing I'd like to point out is that I don't think a lot of people like to face the reality that what you're doing when you, any transaction in a market involves a buy or a sell, and you're selling one asset for another, and
right.
when you make that transaction, you want it to be a winning transaction. And because we're in a world of paper dollars, we sort of think of, as long as the paper dollars, what we did went up when we did the transaction, it was a winning transaction. Not necessarily. So if you're coming into gold at 1400, if you look at a long-term chart coming back from 2000, you're essentially booking a loss on your paper money that has gone against gold from about 46 to 6. So you're buying gold, yes, but you're also booking a huge loss on your paper currency. Now you could say, well, it's going to get worse. It is, but my suggestion would be try to at least wait for a rally in the paper currency so that you can start to get into a bit of a winning mindset. So when you're coming out, you're doing it from a position of strength. Rather than, well, I need to be in this other asset because I failed in the first asset.
Right.
So I think, you know, so that's sort of the mainstream group is they're definitely not buying into this correction. They're just sitting there wondering what's happened. They're looking at the stock market going up. They don't want to go there either. So they're really in watch mode, which kind of leaves us in a neutral position for gold where, you know, we could go lower. They won't buy if it goes lower. So I would, you know, that's almost neutral for gold, what I see there. The funds have been fairly beat up as we've come down because they use leverage. I think they're growing a little disenchanted. They've been in here for, you know, 4 months just drifting sideways. And each rally has looked like it was going to go, and then it hasn't. The gold equities have really been, you know, disappointing. A lot of the stocks that were supposed to really go now are you know, just kind of drifting or even, you know, some of them have their own individual problems that have driven them down that investors hope that if we got over 1400 and rallied from there, could have sort of carried them, and that hasn't happened. As far as, you know, this is the India, yeah, the Chinese have been doing some buying, but it hasn't been enough to overwhelm the physical sellers, especially coming out of that GLD ETF. Indian buying tends to, you know, sort of come in more towards July and even after that. So
right.
We've got some time to go. So I think what I would say is that I personally would not be looking to exit gold now if you haven't exited up towards 1400. If we came down, say, under 1310, I would not be looking to exit. I'd be looking to enter gold then. But if you had to, you know, I really can't call whether we're going higher or lower, but I've definitely built up a lot of cash to buy gold at you know, under into the 12s, into the 11s.
Right.
Some cycle analysis, long-term cycle, looking at like 8 and 9 year cycles on gold suggests we're due for, you know, to go lower. I think the gold community is still kind of living on hope, but there's a level of, you know, just kind of drifting away from gold now. We'll kind of hold on, but hopefully it doesn't go down. And that I kind of see is, again, a little bit dangerous. We could, if you start to go down harder, I think there'll be another wave of liquidation, unfortunately. So I wish I could be more sure.
Well, that's okay. It's very, you know, to me, gold is at the heart of an economic war, and it's very hard to look at it as just a pure market. And a lot of my analysis is geopolitical, and I think that's what's driving a lot of the gold price. So it's, you know, it's very hard to have a certain outlook on gold. It's a little bit like being in the middle of, you know, the battlefield in World War I and predicting what's going to happen 48 hours from now. Anyway,
I think if I was to give, you know, a gold investor, you know, the best advice they could take now with that's interested in gold is to put some gold out on your desk. And if the price goes down, you want to add to that pile.
Right.
It's that simple. You want to add to that pile. And whether it goes down or not, if it goes up, that pile in front of you is going to do well. If it goes down, you want to add.
It's a chance to add.
Yeah. And the same thing, you want to look at the dollar asset the same way. There's like the value of your gold in dollars. There's the value of your investment accounts in dollars. But then there's the cash you hold inside those investment accounts. And if gold falls, that means cash has rallied against gold, the cash
right.
you hold inside the account. So if that were to happen, you've made a profit on that cash. That is almost, you know, almost nobody really talks about that. It's because we're in a dollar financial system, it's not really understood that cash just went up in value.
Right.
And you want to look at another asset that cash has risen against at that point to book some profit on that lump of cash you have in your accounts.
Well, I hate to tell you this, Stuart, my prediction for 2011 is that the toilet paper will outperform money markets by a multiple of 10 times. So think in terms of stockpiling. It's time to stockpile.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, we're out of time. If you could just give us a second and talk a little bit about how we can access you and your work.
Yeah, I'm at basically this is what I do every day. What you've heard here, I kind of it's a little bit more, you know, a little bit different than you know just calling the market directions. We go onto that battlefield every day. As I see, my sign off line is usually see you on the grid lines, and you can access the newsletter at www.graceland.com. And actually, I don't know if a lot of people know, but in the address bar on the computer, you don't need to enter the www anymore in any of these, in any site you're going to. You can just type in gracelandupdates.com. You can send me an email at stuart@gracelandupdates.com. And if you ID as a Solari report reader, let me know about that, and maybe I can give you a little bit extra time on your subscription. I appreciate the business. And just send me any questions you have anytime. I try to answer all the emails. I'm not 100% successful, but I'm 100% successful in trying to answer all the emails, I guess.
It's always I'm very careful about promising to be perfect on that one, because it's near impossible and gets more so every day. Well, Stuart, it's a pleasure to be your subscriber. It's a pleasure to have you on the Solari Report. I wish you good hunting today and every day.
That's really a phenomenal website. I'm glad that Paul brought it to my attention, and it's bookmarked now. So
we're in cahoots.
Appreciate it, Catherine.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye now.
Okay, that's Stuart Thompson from Ontario. Let's go to the movie. Oh, before we do, let's go to the movie. Quickly, two questions came in during Stuart's discussion. Question number one, if you could go anywhere to protect your assets, where would you go? I would go to Switzerland. If you listen to the Solari report we did last year on Switzerland, that will explain why. However, the capital controls that the United States has been putting on make it very difficult and expensive to get there. If anything, Swiss bankers and money managers are sending money back. And I've personally seen that phenomena literally this month. So Switzerland, to me, is the number one place, but it's challenging to get there. And second question, what does depopulation mean? Depopulation means a shrinkage of the population, whether through lower fertility rates or a lower average life expectancy, or simply die-off. I mean, it means the population shrinks through death. You know, and it can happen in war. It can happen with all sorts of economic chaos. A great case study to see depopulation at work is what happened in Russia during the 90s, so take a look at that. Let's go to the movies. I wanted to talk about the Millennium Trilogy. The Millennium Trilogy started with Stieg Larsson's books. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the first one. The Girl Who Played with Fire is the second, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. They came out between 2005 and 2007 and made Larsson, after his death, the number two bestseller globally. The Swedish movie production company Yellowbird has made three movies in Sweden, same names as the novels, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. They're now all available here, and in fact, Yellowbird has done it, and BBC Films have partnered with Sony Pictures to produce American adaptations, which are expected to come out, the first one in 2011 in December, and then the next scheduled for 2012 and 2013. So we'll see redos of those. Now we're watching Swedish movies with subtitles. The primary characters in both the novel and the movies are two of them. Lisbeth Salander is a young, extremely intelligent, very eccentric woman in her 20s. She's got a photographic memory. She's a super computer hacker and some people would call socially challenged. The other is Mikael Blomqvist. He's an investigative journalist with a history similar to the author, Larsson. And it's a lot of his writing and work that helps protect Lisbeth, who also helps protect him. One of the things I've spent a lot of time thinking and talking with a variety of people on our team about is why this movie, these books in this movie, are so popular. And I think if I could point to one thing, it's really Lisbeth Salander, who's somebody I relate to tremendously. She's a young woman who's finally come to the conclusion that there's nothing that the government or the system can do for her. She believes she lives in a world where the rule of law is nothing but a myth, and has decided to just take care of business on her own. She's kind of justice on the just do it method, and takes complete responsibility for her actions, and trying to find a pathway through the sort of the corrupt and covertly controlled mess. And it's really a case study in institutional corruption and people trying to cope with it, whether it's the investigative reporter or the heroine who's decided to take matters into her own hands and navigate the system in a completely unorthodox way, not expecting a lot of help from a lot of people. But it's certainly very interesting. It can be some very strong stuff in terms of violence. So if that's not your taste, you want to be careful. But I think its popularity speaks to the sort of hunger in people to have a look into the real nature of the corruption that we're dealing with. And the Millennium Trilogy certainly does. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the American redos do. And I enjoyed them tremendously and recommend them tremendously, with a caveat. If the violence is a problem, they can be pretty, at times, gruesome. Coming up on March 3rd, we have Blake Levitt, Electromagnetic Environments. It's a issue to me of great importance and concern. She's a real leader in that area, particularly on the question of cell towers. It's one of her books. More on March 3rd. March 10th, again, precious metals. More to talk about, because we are seeing a run-up in prices, a lot of stress in that market. March 17th, Dr. Gwen Scott, my hero for this evening is, in fact, Gwen Scott, who I was been on the phone with this week talking. The title of our March 17th is going to be Aerosol Spraying, Mitigating the Harm to Your Health. This is going to be a particularly difficult one to listen to. We're going to get into the real details of what's in chemtrails and what that does to your body and how you might deal with it. And there's no tougher subject on the planet. And Gwen Scott has done a lot of work with Clifford Carnicom in helping many, many victims of the ailments that come out of aerosol spraying and chemtrails is just an amazing, amazing woman, and somebody who can add a lot of value to all of us. If you haven't checked out the wrap-up, we did a written and graphical version of the annual wrap-up, and I really encourage you. It's a great framework for the Soleri reports this year, and it's quite beautiful, great work by the Soleri team. It's linked to on the part of the archive that has the wrap-up in January. So I really encourage you, and then next week we'll post the list of DVDs for food, and I really think that will help you, if anything, get the teenagers in your life off of junk food. There's some amazing, amazing documentaries, and there are plenty of them. So until we meet again with Blake Levitt on March 3rd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.